All right, here we go. Another one, another week. Ladies and gentlemen, mostly gentlemen, from what I can see in my YouTube stats. I'm here today with Mr. Bob Burnett. Hello, Bob. How are you doing?
Hash rate up. Hardware sales, advisory, hosting, and site brokerage. Find new and used ASIC deals through the website and the Telegram channel below. Make smarter decisions with hash rate up.
Hi, Jesse. How are you? Yeah. all the male audience members, right?
And the three ladies that,
hello, thank you for joining us.
Yes. The three ladies that tune in. You are CEO of Barefoot Mining, of course. You guys do the is it Bitcoin Boomers? Is that the right title?
Yeah. Podcast? Yeah, those watching. Yeah, brand new show called The Bitcoin Boomers with Larry Lepard and Gary Leland.
Definitely check it out. I'm going to share my screen quickly to see where we're at with hash price. So if my eyes don't deceive me, we're at 43.09 US dollars. The next difficulty adjustment is going to be a juicy -3, which makes us excited. After the previous one was another +6. I mean, this might be you. I know you'll have a good take on this, Bob. Where does this hash rate come from? What do you think? Because I'll tell you why I'm asking. Because not too long ago, I was sitting here saying, "Oh, you know, when the Bitcoin network or the hash rate is at 1 zettahash, going up 10% in difficulty is going to be really difficult because you have to add another 100 exahashes." Blah 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 blah. And then 10 days later, that's exactly what happened. 100 exahashes were added. Where is this coming from at 40 hash price? Who's plugging all these machines in? Do you have insights?
Well, I can say that we're still growing hard and fast. And I think a lot of other miners are still in the same situation. But I think we have to always remember that hash rate increases were planned a long time ago. Right? Mm. So, you know, decreases can happen relatively quickly. When things go unfavorable, we can turn off, of course. But even then, people don't turn off just because they don't like, you know, let's say a hash price at 43. They'll give it a little time before they turn off, right? Most people have a little runway, a little buffer. So negative conditions, there's a quicker reaction, but it's a few weeks. But like for us, you know, our expansion, which is going, we're in a rapid mode of expansion right now, were plans that we made in the spring. And if even bigger companies made their plans even before that. And so, you know, we're bringing in new technology. We built our new plans knowing that this possibility existed. It's not what we were hoping for as we came up, but we certainly had it well within our range of possibilities, and we can handle much lower if necessary in terms of hash price.
What is much lower? When you say much lower, where's your, without giving anything away, where do you start to feel real pain?
I can say that, you know, we produce Bitcoin currently for, you know, fully burdened cost of well under $50,000 per Bitcoin.
Including the machines depreciation or without?
Including machine depreciation, and also like we do a lot of off-grid, which I'm sure we'll talk about, but that includes maintenance costs and rebuild costs on generators and things like that. You know, we have quite a bit of runway. Now, that's not what we plan for. It's not what we want. We're hoping for obviously the exact opposite, that we'll see hash price increase, but we can survive for a long time with this depressed level.
All right. Just to complete this, we're recording at 923035. And so you already talked about it, right? I know you guys have a philosophy at Bitcoin, at Barefoot Mining, which is around wild horses, if I remember correctly, and not Bitcoin big mega sites, right? So you want to be, right. What was the cutoff? 20 megawatts? Or was it?
Yeah, better? I mean, it's not a hard number. It's a loose number, of course. But yeah, I think things that you would call small to medium-sized commercial sites are in our space. And yeah.
And so what is the makeup today of the sites that you're running? Like what is... So maybe lead us through the history there of the company a little bit, because I know you guys have been doing this for a while, right? I know you guys did some stuff on hydro before. Now you said you're doing gas. Did it swap all the active sites still online? Did you take some offline? Give me some details there around the development.
Yeah, we haven't taken anything offline. We have, I'd say there's four profiles. One profile is traditional on-grid stuff. It tends to be our older stuff, but we're still able to make it work. Those are on-grid in South Dakota, which, by the way, to those that matters, it's primarily an area of the country where wind and hydro, dominate the grid. We have a hydro site, as you mentioned. It was our first foray into the off-grid world. And that's been operating since 2021. We have an anaerobic digestion site. So we're doing, so it's gas-based, but the source is methane from cow shit from dairy farms. So awesome. we're doing anaerobic digestion. And that's new in the last year. And then our big thrust really is in stranded natural gas. So stranded being defined in two ways. One way is wells that were non-producing wells primarily because they had no pipeline access where we could find gas and either buy the well or get access to the well and take a non-producing source of energy and turn it into a producing one. And the second one is working in alignment with oil production sites where there was either, flaring going on, or they were limited in their oil production because even if they're pipeline connected, they may have restrictions on how much gas they can pump into the pipe. And that would actually reduce the amount of oil they can take. So if we can take some gas on site and help them produce more oil, obviously it means that we can negotiate some favorable conditions.
Let's pinpoint that for a minute, because that's something I just realized and heard for the first time. So you're saying, and I'm trying to re-say what you just said or repeat what you just said. So you're saying these oil production companies, that's their main thing. They want to sell oil. They want to pump oil out of the ground, right? The U.S., right. I think, is the biggest oil producer worldwide, if I'm not mistaken.
I think so, but if not, it's obviously a big one.
I think so. Yeah. It's not what the go-to would be for most people, but I've just heard that on a different podcast, that the US was actually the biggest oil producer in the world, which is crazy to think about. Drill, baby, drill, I guess. What you just said was these guys want to drill oil and there's always a associated amount of gas per metric of however you measure
For every barrel of oil they're pumping.
Every barrel, right? Okay, and then you're saying they can't get rid of the gas. So now they can only flare so much. So that's what limits them in how much they can take out of the ground and sell. So you guys are actually giving them additional value by saying, look, we will not only pay you for the gas somehow that you are burning, but if we work together with you, you can now also sell more oil. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. Yeah. Okay. And there's one other cat. There is one other scenario. And the scenario is that, flaring, I think everybody would agree, it's suboptimal, right? So, like, as an example, by the way, when we consume gas, and like, our standard when we buy generators is we buy all class 4 EPA certified engines. And what that basically means is the emissions out of our engines are far superior to the emissions out of any burning. So so they, as an oil producer, they may have restrictions based on the emission levels. So we, by us consuming the gas and doing it in this very efficient way, the way that we consume the gas, it means they can pump more oil. Or there's another scenario. The scenario is the oil producer may even be able to take the gas byproduct and put it into a pipeline, a separate pipeline, not an oil pipeline, but a gas pipeline. However, if that pipeline is full, they may be restricted in how many MCF per day they can push into the line. So if we can go come in and consume additional, that also frees them up. And so that obviously gives us a great negotiating position.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they're really not, I mean, any oil producer, the gas is somewhat of a nuisance. It's not a major revenue stream. And the more oil they can produce, and by the also NGLs, so the NGLs are also, so in the order of priority as they're running these, they get the most money out of the oil, the second most money out of the NGLs, and the third out of the gas. I mean, and the gas is almost the nuisance.
BidX, solomining.de, got it. Premium made in Germany. You want to go fancy? Go for NerdX or NerdQX++ for a lot of power. Worldwide shipping. Check out solomining.de today.
There's so many, there's such a red tail there, because not only can they sell more oil, it also probably makes their equipment more efficient, right? It can run at higher rates. At least that's how hydro I know works. And I'm sure there's an analogy there. So it's not only just the gas that they can sell that they can't otherwise produce. They produce more and it makes them more efficient. That's insane. I never thought about that. And so what's required on the ground, Bob, to make this work? Because I know, you know, these turbines or generators, they are sitting in the middle between supply and demand from the ASICs. Supply from the gas, demand from the ASICs, and they must run at 50 or 60 hertz, right? And making sure that you always line up your ASIC demand, your power demand, with the available gas, that's not easy, right? And you need to have somebody on the ground that knows all of this, which is in a remote area. How do you find people like that to match up with these projects? What does that look like?
Well, it does require some expertise, but I will say that, you know, a lot of people look at this and I'll also say we almost always invest in what are called gas processing units. So we are processing the gas and making sure we're feeding the engine with something of very high quality. So, and we'll strip out some of the, in a very environmentally friendly way, of course, but, you know, we're stripping out the junk that comes up and feeding pretty much pure methane into the engine. If you do that right, and it costs more, but like our uptimes at our sites in Pennsylvania right now, which is where our focus is, they're over 99%. So we have, and the downtime is almost exclusively engine maintenance, changing spark plugs and belts and oil and things like that. Like we have almost no interruptions due to like the gas composition changing. Now, again, part of that is where we are and the work that we put in to make it. Now, if you're in a site where you're not doing that, you're kind of maybe abusing the engines a little bit. Maybe you're using older engines. Like we use all brand new equipment, and we've just found that it's better to buy new stuff that for instance has warranties, and we try to buy the exact same engine over and over and over again. So our sites, so for maintenance, spare parts, for the technicians that have to work on it, it's not like, oh, we have a cat engine here, we have this engine there, oh, what part do we need? No, we have all of that is pretty much consistent at every site. Because, you know, a lot of this, it comes down to like the total cost of ownership of the site. Could we have saved money on site A or site B by buying a different engine? Maybe. But when you look at the total cost of personnel and spare parts and just know-how and like these sorts of things, you know. And I think that's where we are. That's the sign of a maturing industry, right? That we're at that stage of that's how you get competitive advantage. If there's even such a thing, but you know, how do you keep pushing down the cost curve?
Look, I mean, just to hop in there, we, as Bitcoin miners, we cannot control our revenue. All we can control is our cost, right? So every bit of difference that you can make, and I mean, look, 70 or 50% or whatever of our cost is electricity. And that's also very hard to control. So we're not really left with much. You got to really love this industry. And what you're describing is you're operating between the revenue portion and the non-energy cost. That's where you're operating, and that's what you're trying to optimize. So I think, of course, there's a lot of room, and that's where the difference is made. But yeah, sorry, go on.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, part of it too is like, what does it mean when you say your cost of energy? So like, I could argue that all of our costs are energy. Like for what I'm doing in the wild, what we call the wild side, I am the energy producer. So I typically have some cost associated with the gas.
Mm-hmm.
But it's pretty small, honestly. You know,
revenue share maybe?
No, not really. We don't have to do that right now. But again, I can only say certain things, but if we go back to the type of partner that we have, providing the gas, our value to them, their value is not in the gas. Their value is in another place. So for us to come in and say almost not 100%, give us the gas for free.
Yeah.
No, right?
We just highlighted how much value you're likely adding by just consuming the gas. So they should be happy. I mean, there's probably even an argument to be made that they should be paying you for taking the gas. But
you could. But I like win-win situations. I like, you know, we want them to always want us there. Like to. So then the next thing is, okay, well, what equipment do you have to have? Whether that's to process the gas or buy the engines, maintain the engines, rebuild the engines, like all those sorts of things. That, and then the personnel to manage those. Like, because the personnel to manage the machines themselves is really minimal. We spend most of our time on the other side, right, of producing the electricity. So to a certain degree, we are a miner, certainly, in I think every sense of the word, but we've really become more of an energy producer is really more what we are. And that's where we gain our ability to exist, because we're not, you know, we control that in probably a manner that's more so than anybody. You can have and we do on-grid, right? You can have a PPA, you can have a power contract, but there's still a number of things that can come into play that can change that on a quick basis. So we're trying to reduce those number.
Yeah, but I guess that's, you know, that's what makes you comfortable at $40 hash price, is you controlling more of that cost curve, and you like through vertically integrating, you expanding the space in which you can optimize for yourself, right? You're not, if you have a PPA, that's what you get. There's nothing for you to do there. That's the agreed price. That's it, you know? And it's very unlikely to go down. It's more likely to go up. And your space which you can operate is limited. But you're not, you don't have that situation.
Right, right. And I'm less subject to changes in political forces, to bureaucracy, to taxation, to these sort of things. They're less, I'm not saying I'm immune, but they're
less of a factor.
They're less
because
of
you're
a
off-grid.
Factor.
Yeah. You already said earlier you're mining at way below 100,000 a Bitcoin. I just came up with a short video, these focus episodes that I do. And one video that got a lot of traction was, you know, that if you host a miner, your cost to mine a Bitcoin is not 55,000 because you have to include the depreciation of the ASIC. And even if you put that at 36 months, then you're still at somewhere like 100 or 110,000 per Bitcoin right now with an, I think it was a S21 Pro that I did the modeling on. When you say you are that low at cost to mine, does that include all the capex for the generator and the machines? Are you using depreciated equipment that has basically, well, that you value at zero because you've ROI'd it already? So how do you get there? How do you make it so low?
Well, I think I already mentioned we on the generation side, we buy essentially all new equipment every time. Mm-hmm. So, and we build into the business model, you know, a certain reserve every month for maintenance, a certain reserve every month for rebuilds. So there's two different things when you're dealing with generators. And then on the machine side, we pretty much no longer buy new. So the costs of the machines are in there, but like our sweet spot right now tends to be machines similar to a S19 XP class unit. So maybe, you know, maybe an M50 plus, you know, that area of machine.
Yeah, and, low 20 joules per terahash, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, obviously we're dealing with 3-ish cent or less energy all in, you know, on the other side. And we're not seeing a bunch of capex on the system side. And we think we can get, you know, 2.5-3 years, maybe even a little more. But we're also reserving in our business model. We have a separate reserve for machine refresh. So when we go into a site, we're looking at that site and saying, hey, we're going to be there for 10 years, 15 years.
Yeah.
Producing the energy. And we'll go through 3 or 4-ish replacement cycles. But part of the pitch to our investors, because we don't fund it all ourselves, we have investors typically, is, hey, if you put the money in, there's not a capital call later on. There's not a 3 or 4 year capital call because we're reserving. And by the way, all those reserves, there's 3 reserves typically, maintenance, rebuilds, both generator related, and then machine refresh, server refresh. All those are held in Bitcoin. So the, you know, we're using the appreciation of Bitcoin to help us on those. The rest of the money, by the way, all the free cash flow outside of that gets distributed back to the investors in Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. That's the way that we operate. So we don't really HODL inside our corporate entities. We do only for reserves. Everything else gets shoved back out to the investors. By the way, as do all the depreciation. So one of the things about the way that we work is because the investor is not investing just in a machine. They're investing in the entire site, which includes the energy production.
Okay, so you're doing it site-specific, not company-wide.
Correct. Right.
Is it all, you know, peer-to-peer relationships of you, or is there a way to become an investor? Do you want to explain how that works if people are interested?
Yeah, we have a lot of investors. A lot of people find me through, you know, shows like this, and it sounds appealing to them, and they reach out to us through the Barefoot Mining website, or they DM me on Twitter and say, hey, I'm interested. And, you know, we usually do between 2 and 4 raises per year. I think we'll probably be more toward the 4. So we've got a lot of energy that appears to be lined up that we're finishing our build out from our raises this summer right now, and we've got a lot of energy lined up for next year. Most of it in Pennsylvania, by the way. We're kind of, that's kind of our spot right now, is it's a, you know, a lot of people go to Texas and Oklahoma. It's very, very popular in the US. Nothing wrong with it. But we've kind of found a niche in the Marcellus Basin, which is Western Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Eastern Ohio.
No, and so, fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay, so you basically, because this is one other thing that I wanted to talk to you about, this idea of funneling ASICs, right? You buy new machines. The question is always, oh, what lifetime do they have? Well, if you buy modern equipment and you treat it right, you know, then the physical lifespan can be quite long, right? It's always the financial lifespan that is the question.
Right.
But if you then have sites like yours where you say your all-in cost, the LCOE, levelized cost of energy, is 3 cents or whatever, you know, you span your generator over 10, 15 years, you spread out that cost, then you have a site to send these machines to. Like you just said, the M50s, you know, the S19 XPs. Yeah. And the thing is, the market is flooded with those machines, and it's only going to get more, right? Because we've had such huge upgrade cycles the last time around that all these machines that are falling out of the financial viability window, the more hash price gets compressed. I see them, you know, all day on the channels advertised.
Yeah.
And so that's where you can really make a big mark. And that's why I think mining can be really fun ROI-wise, is because you can ROI these machines in under a year, I'm guessing, right? If you get them cheap enough.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on
buying a lot of stuff?
You said there's no scenario in which you would buy new Auradine machines or whatever to deploy them on a higher cost, less risk site, and then funnel them into your gas sites later on?
Well, I mean, interestingly, I have bought some higher end stuff in the last year, but I would say 80% has been more like we've discussed, and it's really just a deal basis. I mean, we've developed our own model that we run everything through, and you know, we look at available capital, we look at you know, the ROI, and you know, but we don't make, one thing we don't do is we don't pre-buy anything. So we are, you know, we buy when it's time to buy, and we don't, you know, we're not, you know, no, we're fortunate. I think there's several advantages to being the size that we are. And one of them is if you're trying to build out a 200 megawatt site, you may be forced into a situation where you have to go out and pre-buy. But if you have flexibility, like, you know, we've used, for instance, the Auradine machines a little bit. We've used plenty of, obviously, Bitmain and MicroBT equipment. You know, there may be some slight preferences, but they're not dramatic, to be honest. You know, I think that there's some real loyalists out there. But we don't have much loyalty, frankly. We've found, by the way, the biggest issue, this is a tangent, is my biggest issue has nothing to do with performance, efficiency, cost. It has to do with parts availability.
Thank you.
Warranty, turnaround time.
Yes.
Like, because, and I'll be honest, you know, like my... One of the things I'm excited about is, for instance, Block coming in.
Yes.
And Proto. And we've had a lot of discussion with, well, I should say a lot, but we've had plenty of discussion with them. And I'm excited because on the surface, it appears maybe that they understand that component of the business. It's very similar to what I talked about before. You know, when you're running a business, like your uptime is what's really important. And so... If I buy, let's say, like, we've had a lot of issues with Bitmain, as in, I'll just be frank about it. We've had a lot of issues with Bitmain and some with MicroPT. And, you know, that's no secret. And if we buy a machine and we go through weeks of dispute because it's not working properly about, is it in warranty? Is it out of warranty? Did we violate the warranty? Are they going to fix it? Can we get the spare part? Can we get all that? Well, if that thing's out of commission for 6 or 8 weeks, then, you know, do I care that it's one joule per terahash or two joules per terahash better than the other one?
Yes, thank you. Yeah. What? Who cares if it's 2 joules more efficient if you had to touch the machine 10 times over its lifespan?
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
If you can't get any warranty, that's worthless. Yeah, thank you very much. I echo that all the time. And there's a reason why a lot of people in Africa, when it comes to mining, swear by MicroBT, you know, because it's build quality. Yes. It's like, I was talking about this earlier. It's like this, right? We're moving into this era, and I'd love your thoughts around this, of, you know, sub 10 joule per terahash efficiency. Okay, now you get miners with 13.5, 12, 11. Bitdeer is talking about 5, okay? Yep. But to me, it's a little bit like comparing to try. This is a desperate try at an analogy, right? Imagine you own a Nokia 3310, okay? Now, your upgrade to a modern smartphone is a big no-brainer, okay? Yep. But if you own a Google Pixel 9, you know, you're not very likely to upgrade to the Google Pixel 10 just because it has a big camera, right? But if there's an innovative feature that makes the machine more efficient or the phone more usable, like having a headphone jack or USB-C, then you're more likely to buy it, right? I don't think in 5 years we will see machines that don't have hot swappable fans. And if we do, I'm fairly certain that the free market will say, you know, that's not going to be in demand anymore because we'd want hot swappable fans. We don't want to deal with fans that we have to unscrew. The machine is down 24 hours and then we plug it back in again. It's just too expensive, right? We can't afford that. And I think that's where we're going to see a lot of efficiency. Auradine coming out famously with hashboards where if the chip fails, the hashboard doesn't go down, but the chip is gone, but it still works, you know? And if that machine ends up being 3 joules per T less efficient than the next generation, whatever model, then I'm still going to buy that.
This episode is sponsored by Hashbranch, the easiest way to mine Bitcoin in the US. Sourcing hardware and rack space usually is a mess. Bad deal structures, misaligned incentives, and no visibility after deployment. I have placed tens of thousands of ASICs in partnership with Hashbranch. What I like most is that they cut through the noise. Fair pricing, aligned terms, and access to hosting that actually works. Use code HASHRATEUP100, visit hashbranch.com today to get $100 off of each miner that you order.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's, you know, total cost of ownership is, I mean, that's part of a maturing industry. And I think a lot of people in the mining or hashing business, I don't think have reached the sophistication yet of really thinking about their business that way. And it's unfortunate. I think they will either learn it or they'll go out of business. There's probably not an in-between position. But these concepts, I may have talked to you, Jesse, in the past. My background comes from the personal computer industry. I was the chief technical officer for a company called Gateway. So I designed laptops and desktops and servers for a living for 2.5 decades. Well, we dealt with a lot of these same issues. And you know what we eventually, you know, on a personal computer today, if you have a desktop as an example, one of the beauties is, I mean, you could theoretically build your own desktop if you wanted, right? If you're that kind of person, you can go buy a chassis and a power supply and a motherboard and all the different things and you can cobble it together. But if you even buy a Dell or an HP and a part fails, you have lots of different options about where to go get the part. And that's what needs to happen in this business. You know, my estimate is there's about 8 million servers out there. I like to call them servers, but actually there's a reason I do. But whatever you want to call them, at some point there has to be an evolving standard. And it's really disappointing. Bitmain, with 80% market share, couldn't even within their own product line kind of create standards so that there was some level of part interchangeability and things like that that was better.
Is that a result of competition, and that's what we're seeing now, the change? I mean, we have Auradine, we have Bitdeer, we have MicroBT, Canaan, Avalon is doing great things. I'm hearing about reliable servers or ASICs. Yeah. And all of that is competition, and Bitmain has to see that. I mean, they're not
done. Well, I would think they would see it. Hopefully their biggest customers are complaining about these issues. I'm probably not on their radar. But interestingly, like, I came from this world, right? Well, when I was at Gateway, at our peak, we were producing 10 million PCs per year. And so it's a big number, right? Well, our own warrant, so we had a whole departments like that were responsible for supporting our clients. Parts, warranty service, like all those sorts of things. And we learned it was better for us, not even just for the client, it was better for us to standardize, like to minimize the number of different power supplies. You know, use the same motherboard in two different units. You know, like these sorts of things save money for the manufacturer as well. You'll see that with an auto manufacturer, right? You know, they don't, that Toyota doesn't have unique suspension systems and engines and things for every single car. They have, and they do that because it makes them more efficient. For some reason, Bitmain never really got that. It flabbergasted me. But
look, Toyota is the biggest car manufacturer in the world. Here in South Africa, a lot of people drive Toyotas. And if you have a Toyota bus, you can take the suspension or the tires or the whatever and put it on a Hilux, no problem. That's what makes it so sought after. It's because it's so easy to fix. They also get stolen a lot of because of that, but that's a different story.
Well, that's a side effect. Yeah.
It's easy to sell them.
But yeah, you're right. But I think those are the things that us as the users of this equipment are demanding, but it's also ironically the thing they should be doing. And I think you're right. These other brands are seeing opportunity. I think what Auradine is doing is great. I think what Proto is doing is great. And they're focusing on some of these other areas that really affect our profitability. And we can put a number on it. You know, we evaluate
total cost of ownership, like you said.
Yeah.
But so let me ask you this, Bob. How much of a factor is TSMC's chip manufacturing when it comes to how much competition Bitmain can really have if all of the chips come from TSMC and Bitmain has locked in that that production of the chips? Like I'm twofold right now. I don't know what the answer is. Either they have to take the chips, and in order for them to sell the machines, they have to adhere to the market and add all of these great things in, like hot swappable fans and whatnot.
Right.
Or it's the case that the other manufacturers don't have the chips to even remotely get close and produce the volumes that they need to become a danger to the behemoth that is Bitmain with 80% market share, as you said.
Yeah, it's a real issue. And I mentioned to you, I think earlier before we got started, that I'm an advisor to a project. It's called M5ers, where we're designing our own ASIC. And we're not trying to, when I say design our own ASIC, I'm talking about the chip.
Yeah.
The goal of the company is not to design systems. It's to provide chips and follow the personal computer model, with the idea being that to try to be the Intel to the next Dell or the next HP.
Yeah.
And it costs... First of all, it costs a tremendous amount of money to even get an ASIC to production. And then it costs an enormous amount of money to go lock up some level of production. Now, there is a second, I think, viable player, which is Samsung. So Samsung, you can build a competitive ASIC with Samsung as a partner too, but we're really talking about those two at the moment as the only viable folks that are, you know, 3-nanometer-ish capable today and pushing toward 2-nanometer as, you know, the next level. And so when you see things like a Bitdeer that I've talked about, you know, especially these sub 10 joule per terahash per second stuff. I mean, it's primarily coming from process, meaning you need the 2-nanometer, and who can get 2-nanometer out first. There's still a few tricks, I think, that are out there that can be done with a mining ASIC to reduce power and reduce efficiency. But they're small, you know. There are things you can do to save a couple percent here and a couple percent there. But
can I ask a question? So if we're talking about efficiency, what is the lower hanging fruit? More hashes or less power?
They're the same thing. So if you look at the way like Moore's law works, it's basically, you know, how many transistors can you fit? And so how many transistors can you fit in a given space? And there's some other subtle things that are going on, but essentially it's that. And you can take that as completely a power reduction for this. In other words, if you had a given system that used, or let's say you had a chip, it was a single chip, 10 terahash per second chip, you know, and then you went to the next generation. Well, you could say, well, I'm going to have the same 10, same 10 terahashes per second, but with lower power, or I could have a chip the same size and make it twice as fast. Like, you know, they're really the same thing. But I do think what you will see, and again, it's something that can be talked about in more detail later, but I think you're going to see people push toward bigger changes in what happens with one chip. So for instance, you know, you might see like single chips today are typically like a terahash or so, you know, 1 to 2 terahashes per chip. And I think you'll see more like 10 or 15 terahashes per chip, bigger die sizes, start pushing those things. And I think that's really important because it, as we move toward high density, you know, we'll see higher density systems on the enterprise side, commercial miners like us, you know, give me a 10,000 watt system, let's say. But on the other end, for, you know, products like this, I'm holding up a BitX, but whether that's a, you know, a home space heater or, you know, those sort of things, it's gonna open the window, I think, to making those consumer products a lot more viable. And, you know, something I'm pretty passionate about is seeing a revival of the individual miner. And I really hope that the availability of chips, not having to go rescue chips or pull chips off of, you know, boards and all that. That's what most of those folks in those markets are doing. But you see more and more folks like Auradine or Block or my project, where we're willing to offer chips directly to people that want to do innovative things for them. You know, you want to build a rice cooker, you want to build a pet bed warmer, an electric blanket, you know, whatever. I don't care. But, you know, let the world of possibilities open up.
What can we do with this? you know, this is the thing. Like, the fans are still good. The chassis is still good. The control board is still good. This thing has 13 joules per T. This thing has 13 terahash more than the BitX next to it.
Yeah.
And it's not been long.
No, no. And, you know, maybe what we'll see is an aftermarket of people, you know, coming up with a board that you can slap in there that
fits the S9 chassis. That would be fun.
Yeah. But I think that's what we have to open up. And you know, that's Bitcoin is going through an evolution that I believe mimics in a lot of ways what happened with the personal computer. And you know, unfortunately, I was there from the very beginning of the personal computer. I'm that old, and I was working in the design world. So if you're younger, you may not realize, you know, how the personal computer evolved and how similar the adoption curve looks to the to the personal computer, but also the technology evolution mimics, you know, what happened.
Yeah.
And we're still early, but we're not that early. Like we're
decent. I would say also we have progressed a decent amount, but there's still so much more to come. You know.
Of course, yeah.
Yep. Bob, we have reached our time. I could sit here forever and talk to you. We talked a bunch about gas, about barefoot mining, talked a bunch about ASICs. I think it's been a very, very insightful show. I realize how good it is to speak to you, and we have to definitely do this again. Before we go, I want to do a quick round of rapid fire, if you're up for it.
Go for it.
And then, we can close it out. You can tell people where to find you, where to find your shows, and what it is that you do. And then I'll see you the next time when we can pick out a different topic and rant on.
Fabulous.
All right, so here we go. What's your favorite ASIC today?
Favorite ASIC today? Well, I got to say, we are using the shit out of the S19 XP.
There you go. A Bitmain machine, after all.
After all, yeah.
But, how ironic.
You know, ironic. But I am super optimistic about the proto.
It's not going to be a cheap machine to deploy on gas, but it might be easy to operate. Would you rather mine in extreme heat or in extreme cold?
Wow, we do both. Slight preference for cold, but it's probably a lot harder than people think.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll talk about next time why that is, when it's winter your side, that's coming up. If Satoshi were a miner today, what kind of site would he build?
I think, not to sound egotistical, but I think he would like what we're doing. I think he would be kind of appalled by the big PubCo sites. I'm sure he would mine personally with, you know, he probably wouldn't use a BitX, but he'd probably have, you know, something going in his garage. But I think
running a Datum server.
Maybe.
Yeah. All right. If Satoshi, similar, because by the way, my editors can make this into a rapid fire, no problem. I think what you say is interesting because, of course, like, you know, we all should think the way we mine is what Satoshi would do, right? I don't know. It's kind of following our own principles. If Satoshi were a miner today, what pool would he use, Bob?
I think he would solo mine.
Oh, okay. Twist. I thought for sure you want to say ocean. Favorite Bitcoin quote or mantra you live by?
Well, it's an awareness, and I would say, you know, gradually then suddenly. And I think we have to be aware. We were just talking about this earlier, that we're in a spot where things could change so dramatically in the space of even a handful of months. And better be aware of it.
Yep. Cool. Bob, this has been amazing. Do you want to tell people where to find more about yourself, if they don't already know you, and where to find your new show and everything?
Yeah, thank you. You can find me on Twitter. It's where I'm most active, at Boomer_BTC. My company is Barefoot Mining. We're at barefootmining.com. My newest show that I host with Larry Lepard and Gary Leland is called the Bitcoin Boomers, and we're distributed through BTC Sessions. So if you go to BTC Sessions on YouTube or wherever, you'll find that our show is distributed through that platform.
Fantastic, Bob. This has been a great, great time. Thank you so much for sharing some of your time today, and I'll see you next time. Thank you.
Thank you, Jesse.